Literary Reflections from a Master of the Craft, next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer and literary historian R.W.B. Lewis is here now to discuss his latest book, a volume entitled Literary Reflections.
My immersion in American literature began in the spring of 1945 during the last months of the war in an apartment in Florence, commandeered for my small mobile intelligence unit. It was there that I happened upon a copy of Moby Dick in an armed forces edition and read it right through. The experience was overwhelming, akin to a reading of the Divine Comedy over three timeless days at Harvard. And culturally speaking, it turned me completely around. The impact of that quintessentially American book in that...
Literary critic R.W.B. Lewis. He'll be back in just a moment to discuss his latest book, Literary Reflections. Support for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. As a critic, biographer, and literary historian, R.W.B. Lewis has been a noteworthy presence in American letters for nearly 50 years. His interests range from the Greek and Roman classics through modern European writers to Americans such as Ralph Waldo Emerson, Herman Melville, Edith Wharton, the James family, and Robert Penn Warren. R.W.B. Lewis takes a special interest in the historical and biographical circumstances that have inspired the literary imagination. His biography of Edith Wharton won a Pulitzer Prize, and his book, The Jameses, A Family Narrative, was a finalist for the National Book Award 2 years ago. R.W.B. Lewis's new book is Literary Reflections, subtitled A Shoring of Images, 1960 through 1993. He calls his new book a retracing of cultural steps, an overview of the continuing preoccupations of a humanist. I asked R.W.B. Lewis to read from Literary Reflections.
My immersion in American literature began in the spring of 1945 during the last months of the war in an apartment in Florence, commandeered for my small mobile intelligence unit. It was there that I happened upon a copy of Moby Dick in an armed forces edition and read it right through. The experience was overwhelming, akin to a reading of the Divine Comedy over three timeless days at Harvard. And culturally speaking, it turned me completely around. The impact of that quintessentially American book in that Tuscan European environment led me to wonder for the first time about the phenomenon of being an American, about American habits of speech and behavior as contrasted with the European varieties, about American literature and its own characteristics and traditions.
Dick Lewis, welcome back to the National Humanities Center. It's always a pleasure to have you here as a visitor. You were a fellow.
Nice to be here again.
Let's talk about this new book of yours. What do you mean by a shoring of images? What does that amount to?
The subtitle, the background, is a phrase of T.S. Eliot's that these fragments I have shored against my ruin. It means a piling up of critical images, impressions of literature.
Uh-huh. Now, you begin the book talking about what you call a retracing of cultural steps, and you tell us, this sort of surprised me when I came across this, you're a reborn Americanist, or a newly found Americanist. You started your literary career doing the classics.
Yes, I'd started with Latin and Greek both, and in fact, the first essays I ever published were on Homer and Virgil in a magazine called Furioso. In college, I majored in French Renaissance literature, if you can believe it, and went on to graduate school in medieval cultural history. This, in this book, the early essays are on Virgil and on Shakespeare and so on. And I only came to American literature relatively late.
Uh-huh. Tell me about how you became does the label Americanist fit you? Is that something you're comfortable with? That all came out of World War II for you, right?
Yes. I don't mind that word. I would say that I probably am, even though I have a continuing interest if I can say so, professional interest in European writing anyhow. But yes, mainly American and Americanist. And I read Moby Dick in 1945, and when I came back to graduate school a year later, I plunged into what we would call American Studies at the University of Chicago.
Uh-huh. You say, for example, that your doctoral dissertation ended up in a book called The American Adam. Here you are discovering what it means to be an American literary critic, and you're looking back to Americans who are discovering themselves
yes.
as American writers. Is that a title, a phrase that you still find useful, American literature as a process of self-discovery?
I think so. It's a tangled story, Wayne. The American literature as a subject wasn't even identified until the 1920s at the earliest, and it wasn't really taught in American colleges until after World War II. Emerson and Hawthorne didn't think of themselves as part of literature to be taught in a college, but that tradition, if that's the right word, of an American writer facing experience as though it had never been done before continues. Lionel Trilling wrote an essay once in which he said the reason for that is that Americans have no memory, so that each generation thinks it's starting the whole process again.
Uh-huh. But Dick, let's turn to many of the themes that you treat in this new book of yours, Literary Reflections. How would you characterize the state of American literary? We need to make some differentiations here. Literary inquiry, mm-hmm. literary history, literary criticism, as you see it from the 1990s.
From the 1970s, over the last 20 years, literary criticism in America, which is receiving influences from abroad, from France, has been in two major phases, it seems to me. The first one is what we know as deconstruction, which, among other things, argues that texts are entirely self-contained and have little, if any, relation to the world outside them or to the author or to the audience, and that they grow out of the energies of language. There's a truth about the energies of language, heaven knows. Well, that was very influential and widespread throughout the into the 80s. And then there came into prominence the theoretical movement now in the ascendancy, which is exactly the opposite. It said the only thing that we want to talk about in relation to a text is the world outside it. In fact, the text is of no importance at all.
Now, is this what we call historicism?
This is what we call the new historicism.
The new historicism.
And the, oversimplifying, obviously, but in which the pressures of the power centers of the world in which the text was written are all important. Shakespeare was a product of the power centers of the Elizabethan world and so on. And the text, as I say, kind of disappears, and the author is just a puppet in the hands of these, amid all these forces. That's an extreme, but that's the absolute opposite of deconstruction.
Now, where do you find yourself, Dick Lewis, on that? Is it a continuum? Is it an antithesis? I mean, are these forces that are opposed that will never be reconciled?
Those two are opposites, and I think the one, in a way, produced the other. The one that denied the world outside produced the view that the world outside was practically everything. These movements always go to, I think, almost ridiculous extremes. And mixed in with the new historicism is this business of bashing the canon and denying dead white male writers from the beginning to the end. I think that one can learn something from each of them. I certainly have learned from deconstruction. Some of my dear friends and colleagues at Yale. My best friends at deconstruction, and they're very nourishing. The new historicism, how can I put it, irritates me more because it's not only pretentious, as all these theories are, but the historical nature of literary texts has been something that American critics and literary historians have been saying for 70 years, F.O.
Matheson.
It's
a given. It's a given.
Yeah. F.O. Matheson was a professor of history and literature at Yale.
Is it fair to say that your career, Dick Lewis, sort of encapsulates this arc of American literary inquiry? I mean, you fall most, I suppose, squarely into the camp of what's called the New Criticism.
I certainly grew up in it, yeah. What is that poem, Wayne? I have seen them all, yes, seen them all. Anyhow, I have lived through them all. Yes, New Criticism was just coming into power when I was an undergraduate at college, and Matheson was a practitioner of it to a point. So I grew up in that, but I always was more interested in the historical dimension of literature than the new criticism was, even from the beginning.
Well, part of the story that we tell ourselves when we talk about the history of literary inquiry in the 20th century is that we're dealing with aesthetics, we're dealing with texts, we're dealing with ideas, all the sort of noble words. Mm. The other end of this story is that this is a power struggle in the academy amongst the academics. That sort of cheapens the story. Is that too much of an exaggeration?
Well, I do think that much of the time the pressure in favor of this or that theory is a pressure in favor of getting promoted in the English department. I really do think that power struggle, very much within the academy, and not really much related to the world outside, not very interesting to the world outside.
Well, let me look at you wide-eyed, Dick. Why did you write the books that you wrote? Obviously, you were considering things like promotion and tenure, but we need to go beyond that, I take it.
For reasons I can't go into here, I never was too worried, never had to be too concerned about that. I managed to become a professor without ever having been an assistant professor, but that's another story. American Adam was a doctoral dissertation that came out of my studies, rather basic introductory studies of American literature and history. The second book really came out of my World War II experiences in Italy, and began as a long essay on the Italian writer Ignazio Silone, to which I added essays on Moravia and Camus and Graham Greene and Faulkner. But that had its roots in World War II experience. A little later, these things are half accidental, I think, Wayne. I was invited to write a biography of Edith Wharton. I responded very quickly, but I was invited to write it for two reasons. One was her private papers had become available, and an enormous number of them were at Yale. Mm-hmm. And the Wharton estate thought, other things being equal, it's a good idea to get somebody at Yale to write the biography.
Let's pause on that for a moment. Do you see yourself as something of a pioneer, having written a biography of a prominent American woman writer?
I gradually realized that. I didn't go into it for that reason. In fact, I went into it a little questioningly, if the truth be told. I'd written an essay on her. That's the second reason why I was invited. But I had an impression of her as a person, which was the popular one, rather snobbish and austere, who drew herself up when she was, at all put out by anything, and elitist. And when I got into it and discovered she was a very warm and passionate and eccentric and contradictory human being.
Now, is she one of the people that you refer, for example, to Nathaniel Hawthorne, and you give him a label, that he is sort of surprising in the prematurity of his modernity? Is Wharton another one of these characters?
I think she is, although I have to say I don't think you would discover that so much from my book. I was not thinking along those lines, and I think, frankly, I should have considered her much more in relation between her femaleness uh-huh. and her writing. But now, since this book came out with 1975, since then there have been a great many studies of her in this perspective, which do show she was ahead of her time. Yeah.
Why is she worth reading now? Why, not only students, but just in general readers. Why should we look back to her now?
My goodness. Well, she is a master of the art of fiction, and fiction, which also beautifully reflects the time and place in which New York and then later perhaps to some extent Paris, the history up to the verge of World War II, you can find reflected in her fiction.
Mm-hmm. It's also fair to say that her life parallels the life of Henry James. I mean, they knew one another, and here again, we come to another of your subjects in the James family.
He, of course, encouraged her greatly, and encouraged her, I think, in exactly the right way. He was 20 years older, that's right, and, of course, was living in England when she began to write, and her first book was all about 18th century Italy.
Huh.
It's a good novel, but nonetheless, straight historical novel. And James wrote her, he hadn't met her yet, and said, "That's all very well, but you should write about your own place. Do New York," he said.
Indeed.
"Write about New York." And she did. She wrote The House of Mirth, which she found her voice and her theme. And incidentally, the one other reason why she's of great appeal, the role and status of women in American society was a major theme. She was extraordinarily perceptive about that, and never more so than in The House of Mirth.
Well, both of these writers echo, in a way, they go back to one of your early and continuing concerns in The American Adam, that is to say, what is it to be an American?
Yes.
How does one define oneself?
I think Edith Wharton never ceased to be absolutely American, even after, 20 years living in France, with only one or two brief visits back to the United States. And she became more American, if anything, more interested and concerned, more angry about what was happening to American society.
Uh-huh.
So, but I think one of the ways in which the American aspect is intensified is by living somewhere else and see what the differences are. F.O. Matheson wrote a little book called From the Heart of Europe, an account of his year he spent in Prague and in Salzburg, and he began by saying, "I came to Europe to discover what it means to be an American." Now, Edith Wharton never used that phrase, but that's what happened to her.
Uh-huh.
She was much more American in southern France than she'd been in New York.
Matheson is one of these people that we might call the public intellectual.
Mm.
He falls into a
right.
long and a distinguished line of characters like that. You've known them. You've written about them. In fact, I think it's fair to say you're one of them yourself.
Yeah.
What is the role of the public intellectual in our culture? What's become of that role?
I'm beginning, frankly, Wayne, to concentrate on that very subject, and I haven't. My thoughts are only partly formed. I've never quite thought of the public intellectual as a subject, but I more and more see that it is one. It certainly is a writer, a person of ideas who speaks out, who takes his stance publicly on the great issues of the day. Not just one who sits back in his study and says all literature is political. That's not taking a stance at all.
Mm-hmm.
And Matheson did that. I've been, and before that, one of the reasons for my enduring admiration for William Dean Howells is that after the Haymarket riot in Chicago in the 1880s, when six people were condemned to be executed, they were absolutely innocent, and he was the only intellectual, at least well-known intellectual, of his day who spoke up in protest against that. And more recently, John Hersey in
uh-huh.
Hiroshima and other things. And John Hersey marching in the anti-Vietnam protest marches. And Robert Penn Warren writing a book about the book that's called Who Speaks for the Negro, touring the country and recording these comments made. That's the kind of person I have in mind.
Well, we could go all the way back to somebody like Emerson.
Yes, absolutely.
We could talk about people as recent as you yourself, Dick Lewis. We could talk about people like Irving Howe, Gary Wills, Gore Vidal.
You've just written
a long essay about him. Mm-hmm. What has become of this public role? Where's the center anymore? We don't seem to have these towering and impressive individuals who sort of speak to the whole country about sets of ideas, or do we?
I don't think so. It was in the mid 19th century, as you're implying, Emerson, but also Whittier and Thoreau going to jail because he wouldn't pay his taxes. I don't know the answer to your question where they go, but I don't see that figure. Partial reason is I also don't see the public critic, the person like Edmund Wilson, writing in The New Yorker for a general reader on literary matters. Most literary talk, even the most brilliant, is rather specialized and doesn't aim at a broad audience. I haven't written any manifestos as Warren has done and others have done. I don't think I'd be particularly good at that. But I don't write letters to the New York Times. Maybe I should. But I certainly like to make any position I have known.
Yeah. Is there a place for the public intellectual in our mass or popular culture in the 1990s? Have we become too diffuse to really accept somebody who speaks from a single standpoint the way somebody like Edmund Wilson did?
I don't know. Who knows whether it's a matter of talent? I mean, Wilson had such extraordinary talent. There may be others writing in somewhat the same form. I think there are. As a matter of fact, Morris Dickstein's book called The
Double Agent.
The Double Agent speaks to this point, and you might reconsider. He speaks about who are the heirs of Wilson, mentions writers that are much less well known but are trying to address the general audience in the same way.
Dick, as you look around at American writing, American literature in the 1990s, are there names that come to mind? I'm not trying to get you to play favorites here, but just reflect on the question. People who sort of follow not only in the role of the public intellectual, but who pick up the baton, as it were, according to your notion of the pattern of American literary history?
There are certainly writers and poets that I greatly admire. I'll mention one novelist, Don DeLillo, and one poet, Amy Clampett, both of whom I think very highly of. I don't think of them as publicly pronouncing, though. I think they deal with matters that are of public relevance, but I don't think of them that way.
Do we have any more what you call the James family, the most extraordinary intellectual family in American history? Is that gone? Is that a thing of the past? Any more Jameses around?
It well may be. They were. There's certain special things about the Jameses. One is the Irish inheritance of extraordinary expressiveness and keen interest in everything, plus a great deal of humor, which came down through the father, Henry Sr., who was a man of real genius, down to son William and son Henry. And then they were a self-oriented family. I mean, they partly because they moved around. The father moved them around Europe a lot and moved them around different places in the United States. So they didn't have a hometown that they all grew up in. Their hometown was their own family, and this means they nourished each other. They watched each other.
They practiced the art of becoming Jamesian, isn't that?
They certainly did. William said about Henry, after he'd visited Henry in England, was saying he's getting awfully English and all this stuff, but he said, finally, he said, Henry is neither English nor American. He's a native of the James family and has no other country. Yeah, right. And William meant that as kind of admiringly. Although William himself was distinctly American, no question about it.
Dick, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. Mm-hmm. You're engaged in two projects now. You're writing a book about Florence, and you're writing a book about Robert Penn Warren.
Right.
Can you tell me very quickly how those projects are moving along?
Well, quite practically, it is a two-book contract with the publisher in New York. The Florence book is close to finished. It's a labor of love, almost a love letter to Florence. We've lived there so often, and it's rooted in the personal experiences and what they have meant. The Warren book is a biography with special emphasis on the poetry, because the poetry, especially in his last 30 years, served to give shape to his life experiences, so the biographer can draw on the. It'll be a life story, but geared to the poetry. Okay. That's in an earlier phase than the Florence book. I will finish this fall.
Well, Dick, I want to thank you for coming by to participate on Soundings. Let me tell our listeners about you. You are R.W.B. Lewis. I've always wanted to say this. Richard Warrington Baldwin.
You got it.
We know you as Dick Lewis here at the National Humanities Center. Your books include The American Atom. That goes all the way back to the mid-50s. More recently, you are the author of The Jameses, A Family Narrative. And your brand new book is Literary Reflections. It's just out from Northeastern University Press. Dick, it's always a pleasure to have you at the center and to talk with you about your work. Good luck in your work.
Thank you very much, Wayne.
This is Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. In just a moment, I'll tell you where to write if you'd like a cassette tape of this week's show. You've been listening to a conversation with R.W.B. Lewis, Professor of English and American Studies Emeritus at Yale University. Send $5 for a cassette tape of this program or $2 for a Soundings catalog. The address is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Please ask for program number 676. That's number 676, the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, the zip code 27709. Next week, a conversation with novelist Mark Richard. He'll be here to read from and discuss his new book, Fish Boy. Soundings is made possible by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities, with additional funding from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Until next week at this time on this radio station, this is Wayne Pond. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.